You're listening to STEMcast, brought to you by McGill iGEM.
Hi everyone, welcome back to STEMcast. Today we're joined by Sharif Darwish. So jumping right into it, Sharif, could you tell us a bit about your personal journey to where you are right now in your career path?
Sure. Thanks, Lauren. Appreciate being asked to do this. Sounds pretty cool. I met John Abbott. It's a SAGEP in Montreal. I think most of your listeners will probably recognize it. Maybe some even attended it. But I've been here for a long time. I think this is my 18th year. I came from Nova Scotia to study at McGill in biology originally. I just really wanted to get out of the Maritimes, to be honest, at the time. When I was like, took a year off after high school, something that I think was a very good decision, something that I'd still like encourage students to do. Like if they're not sure exactly if university is their path or if they just need to take some time. I knew I wanted to go to university. There was lots that I wanted to learn about. I was at that point already very obsessed with plants and fungi. So I knew that I wanted to study life science. But there just wasn't a whole lot going on in rural Nova Scotia. So Montreal seemed like the place to be. I didn't really look in too much about the universities here, but I heard about McGill. So I applied there, got into the bio major there, but it was pretty general, and without doing SAGEP, you have to do, you know, it's a four-year undergrad, so the first year you do your kind of fundamental biology, chemistry, physics, calculus, all that, and I already had my interest very set, so by the time I was finishing that first year, I learned about the McDonald campus and their botanical science program, and botany was kind of the, ethnobotany specifically was what I was really into at the time. So ethnobotany is kind of looking at like indigenous cultures' use of plants for food, medicine, religious purposes. So I had a pretty strong interest in like hallucinogenic plants and fungi, how they're used in South America primarily. Favorite botanist, Richard Evan Schultes, was a big influence. His books, along with Wade Davis, which is one of his students, and he's a rightly celebrated Canadian explorer and botanist. Did a lot of work with coca. So all that was kind of where my mind was at then. I loved botanical science. It was a very small program. It's not even offered anymore at this point. It was me and one other person that graduated from botany at that time. And I knew I wanted to pursue, like, continue on and do some research afterwards. So there was a new professor coming into the school, Dr. Jacqueline Bead. She was doing stuff on plant-insect interactions, and that was one of three things that I thought I wanted to learn more about and do work in. So, you know, mycology being one, right? Something about fungi. But I was getting into, like, thinking about, like, complex systems. So, like, interaction stuff was kind of on my mind at that point. And I always liked molecular things and chemistry of plants and all of that. So I ended up doing my master's on plant-insect interactions, looking at how plants respond to caterpillar herbivores. So from the plant perspective, what kind of gene transcriptional events are happening in response to being eaten and attacked by caterpillars? So looking at like the first half hour to an hour of changes, by doing that like small window, like immediately after the attack, really we were trying to find transcription factors that would kind of initiate these cascade responses that would lead to increase in toxins, insecticides, things like that. And, you know, when caterpillar takes a bite out of a tobacco plant, for example, the nicotine levels will go very high very quickly. But we were looking for the signals early on and controlling for what are the signals in the caterpillar that the plant's responding to, and can the plant differentiate a caterpillar from mechanical damage, for example. And they can, and that's from like a body of research now that we know plants can respond very specifically and very quickly to these attackers, and it'll be different than they'll respond to some sort of mechanical damage. So I'd go around with nail clippers and have some test groups of plants where I'd take bites out of, you know, fake bites out of the leaves. And then the plants with the caterpillars, intact caterpillars would be put on. And then other plants, I cauterized shut, kind of melted shut one of their salivary glands to control for those chemicals to see if that was responsible for the specific response. So I really enjoyed that. It was tough, as it should be. At that point, I kind of knew that, you know, I was kind of thinking about what I wanted to do. Research can be difficult. I tend to get, you know, kind of demotivated when things aren't going well. And with grad work, you got to be prepared for things not going well for months and months on end sometimes, which was a very good experience for me. During that time, I had a chance to teach. So I was kind of self-taught in fungi, about fungi with mycology. I'd taken a, you know, one credit intro to fungi course at Mac, which was awesome. It was the best, right? You just go in the field, pick mushrooms, bring them back to the lab, look at their spores. It was the best. And there was a 3-credit biology of fungi course. And I'd be the only one that would sign up for it every year. And so they would never offer it. And then after I graduated, they made it required. So I missed out on that. But the teacher, the main mycologist at Mac, was taking on a deanship. And her PhD student was finishing and leaving. So she asked me if I could teach it. And I jumped into that, probably naively. I probably did not do a very good job. but I had such a strong passion for fungi that the classes went really well, like in terms of, you know, the students were on board and all of that. And that really like ignited, that really turned me on to like, this is what I want to be doing. I like talking to people about biology. I like, you know, my friend, I don't have a lot of science friends that I spend a lot of time with, like on weekends and stuff, but my friends would get earfuls about this stuff, you know, talking about, you know, ranting about, you know, transcription, translation, and mycology at 1 a.m. at you know, a house party or something like that. So that was kind of my persona within my friend group anyway. So I think that a lot of that kind of led me to teaching. And then I just, it was just very fortunate that there was a position that opened up at John Abbott when I was finishing my master's. And yeah, and then I managed to get an interview, and there, you know, there's no forced retirement at SAGEP, so someone either has to retire or die to open up a position. So luckily that happened, and yeah, kind of been happily here ever since.
So everyone who knows you knows that you love fungi, so what exactly is your favorite mushroom?
Favorite mushroom? I don't know about that.
It's too many.
I mean, right now it's morels because I just had my most successful morel harvest last week. So I don't know if you know what morels are.
No, I don't.
You know, so I know you can't see this. Your listeners can't see this, but... Yeah. But
I'm sure they're awesome.
Yeah, they're amazing. So
they look like brains.
Yeah, for sure. So they're in the... Most people think of mushrooms as like the typical gilled mushroom, like you'd find in the grocery store. That belongs to a phylum called the Basidiomycota.
Yeah.
So the Basidiomycetes make their spores on these structures called basidia. But these morels, these are the early spring mushroom. And they're in this different phylum called the Ascomycota, and Ascomycetes make their spores in Asci, and they're actually where like a lot of the molds that you see around belong to this group. Truffles belong to the Ascomycetes and all that. So yeah, right now I would say morels, just because it was like a dream. I'd been dreaming about going foraging like in the woods for morels for literally months. Like I'd been like all winter. I'd be having like at least 3 times a week, I would have these vivid dreams about like finding these huge fleshes of morels. And so it was literally like a dream. Like my girlfriend and I found a few like 3 weeks ago, and we were just over the moon, me especially. And then the week later I went on my own and got like, you know, half a kilo of these morels, these yellow morels. Morchella esculenta. They're just so good. Just so exciting. I mean, the hunt is the best part. The eating's bonus for sure,
yeah.
And they're awesome. But yeah, just the searching, learning about the ecology. That's the big thing about, like, you know, one of the main joys of mushroom foraging, like foraging for edible fungi.
Mm-hmm.
Just like you're out in the woods and you start learning the associations between, like, okay, these are all growing at the base of like oak trees. Or like where there's also some pine in the area, and that can give you an indication of, you know, soil pH or structure. It's called the, like, sandy soils more than clay soils. So it kind of brings together a lot of aspects of, like, biology, ecology, nature, all the, you know, just nature appreciation, biophilia, right? Like the E.O. Wilson, you know, some of your listeners probably recognize, died a few years ago, but he was one of the great communicators of biology. And he has a book about biophilia and how we're kind of like evolved to find great beauty and meaning in natural spaces and in biology. So foraging mushrooms is a great way to tap into that.
Are there specific, like, symbiotic relationships between certain mushrooms and trees? Like,
oh yeah, big time. So it's kind of interesting. The last few years, fungi have kind of like become media darlings. So it's wild. Like, I've been ranting about fungi since like the mid '90s to my friends and stuff. And I mean, anybody that's into fungi tends to be pretty over the top about it. So I'm certainly not like unique in this regard at all. But it's kind of interesting that it's bleeding more into the public consciousness now. And so you likely have heard about, like, trees communicating with each other through an underground network. And so that all involves this lifestyle called mycorrhizae. So mycorrhizal fungi, anything myco is fungus, rhiza is root. So mycorrhizae are fungus roots. It's where the fungus will grow into the roots, but it doesn't penetrate the root cells themselves. That would be a parasitism. But the mycelium, which are the thread-like parts of the fungal body, it's very familiar to anyone that's looked at a patch of mold, and it kind of looks like a cotton ball, right?
Yeah.
And a cotton ball, just like a cotton ball, it's made up of a whole network of very thin fibers. So that's essentially what the body of the fungus is. Mm-hmm. And then a mushroom is just like the apple on the tree, right? We call them fruit bodies for that reason. Fungi absolutely are not plants. So that's one kind of pet peeve when people think of them as, you know, a weird kind of plant. They're far more closely related to animals than they are to plants. So one lifestyle that's evolved on terrestrial ecosystems is fungi cooperating with plants at the root interface. The plant photosynthesizes, so sugar is very cheap for the plant, where organic matter is what the fungus is looking for. And the plant is not very good at finding trace mineral nutrients like phosphorus and, you know, potassium, these, you know, these trace minerals and that are required. And the fungus is very good at getting that because its structures and cells are very, very thin. So it has an extremely high surface area to volume ratio. So the fungus explores all the nooks and crannies of the soil, and excess phosphorus and, you know, even nitrogen, things like this, get transported to that fungus root interface. And they trade, right? They just kind of like do a barter. The fungus gets sugars in exchange for these mineral nutrients. And that's where you often see mushrooms popping up underneath trees that often will indicate that there's that relationship going on. Some trees, like the conifers, many of them are strongly mycorrhizal. Oak, very strongly mycorrhizal. Like a single oak tree or pine tree could have several different species of fungi colonizing different roots of the tree. So you can have these entire communities kind of like physically interacted and kind of networked together, like very literally networked together by the fungus. And so the fungus in forests, because, you know, the trees that dominate a forest, most of them will likely be mycorrhizal to some degree. You get this subterranean network of hyphae, mycelium being, you know, what we call like a whole cottony network of fungus, to the point where, like, you know, a cubic centimeter of forest soil can have well over a kilometer of these threads. And so it's just mind-boggling when you think about, you know, square kilometers of forest, how many billions and billions and billions of kilometers of fungus is mm-hmm. helping to kind of keep that together, and it's resisting erosion, it's providing soil fertility, it's just doing all kinds of fantastic ecological.
I find that kind of similar to how, like, cells communicate to each other.
For sure. And this is like very, you know, there's communication between different types of fungi, right? Some fungi parasitize other fungi. So mm-hmm. lobster mushrooms, for example, delicious. And they're called lobster mushrooms because they're like, look bright orange red, like a cooked lobster. But it's actually a species of Russula that gets parasitized by this powdery like fungus that just grows this crust over its gills and essentially just replaces it with itself. So you have that kind of parasitism going on. You have the mutualism with like mycorrhizae. All of these things are mediated chemically. And again, that's what kind of like was in my locus of interest when I was deciding on grad work and things like that. It's like, what is the molecular language that's allowing these complex interactions to occur? Right? And so fungi, plants, they're great, you know, great organisms for thinking about that, because plants don't move, like they, you know, they're sessile, they're kind of stuck in place, so they have to fight chemically, they have to communicate chemically, and fungi likewise. And there's a lot of that. Because fungi and plants likely co-colonize land, there's this concept called hypersea. I don't know, it's not that much in vogue, but a couple of decades ago, there was a book called Hypersea that was written. And it's kind of this idea that like land, terrestrial plants and fungi kind of brought the sea with them. So the salinity and things like that of their cytoplasm kind of reflects that of the sea. So to be able to like evolve from marine habitats into terrestrial ones, that kind of had to bring the sea with them. And in that way, you can almost think of this network of fungal mycelium as being, you know, these very thin tubules of fluid, almost like hydraulics that's linking everything together.
Interesting. Yeah. Are there fungi in the sea?
There are, yeah, but there are some different groups, and there wouldn't be ones that, they're not really like mushroom-producing ones. Okay. In that way. So there are some weird groups of fungi that people don't like think about a lot, like mm-hmm. the oomycetes are one that sometimes like in fish tanks, fish will get parasitized by it, things like that.
Okay. Yeah. That's kind of bad.
Yeah, I mean, the bulk of plant diseases are fungal in nature. So like fungi, if you're a plant, fungi are your main concern, mm-hmm. you know. Viruses, of course, bacteria, of course, but fungi are the great both friends and foes of plants. So, and again, that makes sense when you think about their evolutionary history with each other. Oh, this fungus wants organic matter. Okay, well, cooperating with a plant in that mycorrhizal kind of way is one, but just eating the plant alive or killing the plant and eating its dead body is a great strategy if you can do it too. Mm-hmm. Likely what's still happening is that some of these mycorrhizae, if the plant is not being very productive, mm-hmm. the fungus may start to express genes and proteins that start causing some disease, the plant to get what it wants. Mm-hmm. Same thing with lichens, right? Lichens, people often mistake it for moss on the side of trees, but if you look at like, you know, old gravestones and things like that, you see these like orange and, you know, these orange splatters of what look like moss to many people, but not moss at all. Lichens are essentially fungi that have evolved to agriculture. They're fungi that sense, right, chemically sense these bacteria, these photosynthetic algae or bacteria in the environment, and then kind of enslave them between these layers of fungi, and they get sugar from the photosynthetic activity of the algae. But if they're not very productive, they can start to eat them. So,
what makes a fungi like differentiate between becoming a parasite or like creating a symbiotic relationship with a plant?
Yeah, and it's fluid, right? When one species can be both to even the same partner in that sense. But parasitism means that you're taking nutrients away from the partner you're interacting with to their detriment. Right? Mutualism, you're both benefiting from the interaction, whereas a parasitism, you're harming the host for your benefit.
Okay.
But it's in like a living together kind of sense. It's a little bit different than predator and prey, because predator and prey don't live together mm-hmm. in that way. But when we say symbiosis, people, when they say symbiosis, usually mean mutualism, like a mutualistic symbiosis, but parasitism is a type of symbiosis.
Okay.
So it's those fungus roots I was talking about. So it's the fungus like growing into the root of the plant. And so it's this, you know, it's this these fungus roots. And there's two broad categories. There's the endomycorrhizae and the ectomycorrhizae. Endomycorrhizae they're everywhere. Like over 90% of all plants have that association, right? In botany, sometimes they say like the root systems of plants are the hidden half of the plant, but the fungus of the roots is like the hidden half of the hidden half, right? Nobody talks of, like, not nobody, but, you know, I'm always going off about this in my general biology class that, like, fungi are criminally neglected in introductory biology courses. Mm-hmm. And it is criminal. Like, I think that, like, people need to be held to account. So, I mean, it's insane that, you know, people go through, yeah, well, maybe not prison, but I mean, we need, like, serious reform. These things, it's shocking that just dudes will go through, like, a science program at the college level and barely know where fungi fit and even, like, a, you know, the simplest phylogenetic tree.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a, I could rant about that a long time. But
okay. Okay, so you mentioned that you focused your research on plant-insect interactions. So could you give us some examples of interactions between plants and insects?
Yeah, well, I mean, again, it's like with fungi and plants, there's all kinds. There's mutualisms, there's lots of parasitisms. It's like this. But again, what I was mostly focused on was this herbivory, which is like a type of predator-prey kind of thing. But maybe the most important, just quick point, is that pollination is probably the, you know, the one interaction that is most important to, like, you know, think about when we think about plant-insect interactions, honeybees and all that kind of thing. Honeybees just being one species of bee. There's thousands of species of bee, just as there are thousands of species of ants and beetles and all these things, and many of these insects are important pollinators of plants. So again, plants not being able to move around to spread their genes, they often use animals to accomplish that movement, right? To take carry pollen from one flower and transmit it to the female part of a different flower. And we think that was actually one of the reasons why you got this, like, almost sudden explosion of flowering plant diversity. Darwin called it, in the fossil record, you see, like, barely any flowering plants. It was all, like, ferns and mosses and, you know, pine, you know, like conifers and things like this. And then all of a sudden, all these, like, flowering plants just explode in variety. Darwin called it this abominable mystery, right? It's like it bothered him. And it kind of coincided with this explosion of insect diversity as well. And likely what was going on is this kind of feedback of specialization that was happening, where insects were speciating as they became specialized on the emerging plants that were occurring. So pollination's huge,
yeah.
In the, you know, in that way, you know, it's very difficult to understand plant structure, like particularly their flowers, without understanding insects. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are many important non-insect pollinators, like bats, of course, but insects are probably, like, the most important biological pollinators, right? Many plants pollinate through the wind, water, and so on, but...
How do bats pollinate?
They pollinate very strong flowers, so when they grab onto the flower, it doesn't break off,
no.
But yeah, they just gobble up nectar, right? It's the same... Again, plants that are pollinated by animals tend to have showy flowers to attract them visually, smells to attract them. Nectar rewards the base of the flower, mm-hmm. So the bat needs to stick its head, like, way down into the flower to make sure that the pollen gets on its fur. So yeah, there's, like, big flowers, right? But that's it. Once you start paying attention to this stuff, you know, what's just making a little bit more sense, right? White flowers, okay, maybe they're pollinated by nocturnal animals that don't, you know,
see the color.
That's right. And yeah, and they often smell really good too, mm-hmm. So you get these, like, sensory cues in that way. So that's, like, what those are, some interactions. But there was one that I did a project on in my undergrad, like, finishing off my botany degree, that I thought was so interesting. There's like nectaries. So nectaries are structures in flowers that produce nectar, but there are extrafloral nectaries. There are many plants that will produce glands that secrete, like, sugary, nutrient-rich droplets, but from leaves and stems, not from flowers. But it's still there as a reward for animals. So why would a plant want to do that? And it's usually ants. So if you were, like, a cherry tree, why would you produce leaves that produce nectar outside of the flower? extra floral nectary. What do you think?
I don't know.
So the plant is attracting all these ants, and the ants will protect the plant against large herbivores. Right? So as long as the plant is giving them these like sugary rewards, if you know some like a caterpillar comes around, the ants will attack that to protect their home plant.
Right? I've never seen an ant attack a caterpillar.
Yeah, but you know.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's a world, dude. It's insane. It's the grand dance of it all. I get, you know, I have a tiny little outdoor courtyard space, and I have like two trees there. And in the springtime, I just like, I'll just stare at like this just stream of ants going, like they're going up into the tree because I know they know that the aphids are coming.
Yeah.
So they go up there, and this isn't extra floral nectaries, but this is aphids that are attacking the maple tree, and aphids have these mouth parts that like kind of suck the sap out of the cells of the plant, so they're kind of like stuck in place a little bit. And then ants go and they'll eat the aphids. Many ants will actually just like cultivate the aphids. They'll move them around like kind of like cowboys, and the aphids are their cattle, and they'll move the aphids around to more productive parts of the plant, and then they'll drink the net, like the sugar water that comes into the butt of the aphid. So you get these complex, that's what you call like a tritrophic interaction, right? Like three levels of interactivity going on involving these insects and the plant. So yeah, extra floral nectaries, those are super cool. So that's, again, it's like, what ecological role are these structures serving?
So could you please just tell us a bit more about your research of the like the interactions between caterpillars and
plants? So they so I was looking at this. So it's a, we're using these model systems. So in science, in biological science, you have model organisms, kind of organisms that are used kind of universally in a certain field. So like the fruit fly is a big model organism for animals. Yeast is a big model organism for fungi and for like unicellular eukaryotic biology. C. elegans is a worm that's used for a lot of developmental biology. So different sub-disciplines have their model organism. So Arabidopsis thaliana, it's this, you know, it's this little weedy plant. It's not very exciting to look at, but it's a, you know, its genetic architecture and its biology make it, you know, well-suited for research. It doesn't do these kind of mycorrhizal interactions, so you can kind of like remove that as a factor that could be influencing how it's responding to things, because there is research that shows if the plant is has functional and active mycorrhizal fungi in the system, it helps them with their response to being attacked and all these kinds of things. So, you know, to focus on the plant interaction and not the plant fungus interaction to that, you know, it's important to have a plant that, you know, you're kind of taking away these confounding factors in that way. So it's a very simple plant, Arabidopsis, and then beet armyworm was the caterpillar. It's not the most attractive caterpillar, but it's an important pest. So more in the south, we don't have it so much in Canada. With climate change, that could change as they migrate more north. But it is an important pest crop, so it's important to understand how plants respond to this to, you know, maybe develop some strategies to use like natural immunity of plants to protect against those things. So essentially what I was doing is like growing like the caterpillars and growing the plants, and then, like I said before, kind of like having, you know, the different treatment groups have the controls where nothing was, you know, they're just left intact. The mechanical damaged treatment and the two caterpillar treatments, right? The intact caterpillars and those that have the modified salivary glands. And I would do this at night. They're nocturnal feeders, so I'd do this at night in the greenhouse at like 2 a.m. I'd be like in the greenhouses with like green glow sticks because I didn't want light frequencies that activated photosynthetic pathways. So I'd be there with like glow sticks, like, you know, from 2 to 5 a.m. You know, I'd usually start around like 10 or 11 and then, you know, finish at 4 or 5 when I'd have to do these collections. because I got to time it. Again, I'm trying to look for like early transcriptional responses. So that was really the theme. Like early transcriptional responses to caterpillar herbivory in this model plant. And so collect the leaves directly into liquid nitrogen. So end up with like these, you know, different samples in different tubes on liquid nitrogen, and keep those stored. And then quickly after did an RNA extraction. So I was looking again at transcriptional responses. So I needed to work with the mRNA, and RNA is very difficult to work with. It was then, at least. I don't know what kind of, like, you know, I'm sure there's fancy methods now to keep it well preserved or protected, but it breaks down really easy just because there are these enzymes, nucleases, RNAs everywhere. So, you know, you just look at RNA the wrong way and it breaks down. So, you know, carefully extract all this mRNA and then quickly turn it into cDNA, complementary DNA. DNA is far more stable. So extract the mRNA, make the cDNA, and then I would do a modified PCR method called cDNA AFLP, amplified fragment length polymorphism. Completely outdated now. I doubt anybody does this at all. There's much more advanced, powerful techniques available now. But I was essentially just like fishing. So I would have these primers, these PCR primers with slight extensions on them. And so I would just be amplifying subpopulations of the mRNA fairly randomly, looking for spots. So then I'd run this modified cDNA AFLP and this, you know, following this PCR process, run it on these acrylamide gels and look for areas that differed from, you know, between the treatments. Again, no idea what it codes for, so looking for some of these things and then find a couple of spots like, oh, there's something that was expressed in the control that's no longer expressed in the treatment. So part of the hypothesis was that the plant is going to downregulate genes for production, like for photosynthesis, and upregulate genes for defense. So, you know, mRNA that went down is also very interesting. So whether it goes down or, hey, here's a spot, here's a band on the gel that's in the caterpillar group, but it's not in the control group. Oh, maybe they're activating a gene for defense. So then identify those and then go to the gel and with a razor cut out that tiny little area and then resuspend that fragment, and then send that to the genomic center downtown to get sequenced.
That's also what we do.
Awesome. Yeah. And so this is, and so it was like a year and a half of doing all this stuff. And then there was like one day where I got an email back from them. They're like, here are your sequences as a file or whatever. It's like, all right, let's find out, see if I found anything. And just spent like, you know, the afternoon on NCBI and just blasting, you know, just copying and pasting them, just blasting them. It's like, what could this be? I can't remember what any of it was, to be honest. There was a few that seemed like they were promising, but that's the nature of research, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, this was the first, you know, I was the first graduate student in this new professor's lab. She was on maternity leave pretty much the whole time. So, you know, we'd be having lab meetings at her place while she's like breastfeeding in the kitchen. But it was very good in that sense that I had a lot of autonomy, and I do tend to like a lot of like mm-hmm. independence and yeah. autonomy. So that was great. But being the first kind of research happening in that lab, you're kind of trying to establish some questions and some work that can be taken on by the next, right? You're kind of like passing the baton on. Okay, well, I found a couple of these things that might be interesting. Okay, now someone else, look more deeply at these specific genes.
Do you know if other people will continue your work? Or?
I think so, but I don't know if much happened with that. I'm not sure what the current state of that is. Her lab did like kind of the caterpillar side, so there's a woman I was working with, Megali. She was awesome. That's it. Grad school is really like that's when you really feel like a scientist. And so I had a great lab partner. Yeah, she was on the caterpillar side. I was on the plant side. Yeah, and then. You know, I don't know how much work is actually happening at the lab now. you know, it's a tough road as a professor, right? If you don't kind of like get a really like, you know, if you don't have a very active lab that's producing lots of papers and interesting research questions, you can lose momentum and you can start losing, and then become more difficult to get your funding and all that kind of thing. You start doing more administrative stuff. So I'm not exactly sure what happened afterwards, but like I said, that's when I started teaching that fungi course, and then by the time I was done my master's, I was over it.
You know, yeah.
Awesome.
So do you know anyone who's doing research on fungi? Or?
I mean, there's lots of people doing research on fungi.
Most important ones.
Yeah, I mean, again, I don't know what the most important one. Again, that's it's too broad. It's like,
yeah.
Saying it's like, who's working on animals? Like, who's doing the most important animal
true.
Work? It's like, again, this is the frustration.
It's like your idol.
Well, it's you know, fungi are one of three multicellular groups in the known universe, right?
Yeah.
We've got animals, plants, and fungi.
Yeah.
And fungi are always treated as this kind of like, mm-hmm. you know, middle child, odd, you know, like odd. Maybe that's why I have an affinity. I'm a middle child of two brothers. So. But, you know. Research-wise, different fields, you know, you could look at medical mycology. That's all, like, fungal infections that people get, right? And that's a very important field. Climate change is introducing, like, a lot of uncertainty about how that might relate to increases in fungal infections of people. Fungi are difficult to treat, partly because their cell biology is a lot like ours.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is back just that simple realization that fungi are more closely related to animals than they are to plants. Oh, that's why it's difficult to treat, you know, an antibiotic that we use against bacteria, you know, for example, a big target could be the bacterial ribosome, right? The 70S ribosome of bacteria. Well, you can't use that for fungi because they're eukaryotic and they have an 80S ribosome like ours. You can't attack, you know, peptidoglycan, that's a bacterial thing. Fungi have chitinous cell walls, but you can't, there are some antifungals that target chitin. Most antifungals target their version of cholesterol called ergosterol. So there's that whole world of medical mycology,
mm-hmm.
where there's research on like effects of climate change on the incidence of mycoses. Mycoses are the technical name for fungal disease. Then there's all the like mycorrhizal stuff, you know, in terms of ecological interactions. There's huge boom in research on using psychoactive fungi in therapy. That's where a lot of people nowadays are getting introduced to the world of fungi, is hearing about using psilocybe fungi. So psilocybin and psilocin are these two alkaloid compounds that a bunch of fungi produce, mostly in this genus called psilocybe. Psilocybe cubensis is the mushroom that people typically call magic mushrooms, and that became the research into that became decriminalized several years ago, and so there's been this boom in research into, you know, and even with that they're very, you know, they're great tools for neuroscience, right? Have you studied like the serotonergic network of the brain, because these molecules work on the serotonin network. Use that to highlight parts of the brain, to study brain disease, things like this, but also for treatment of things like PTSD, end-of-life anxiety, things like this. So people are, that's likely the thing that, those are like sexier stories for the media, like for news and stuff, right? But in terms of like, in terms of books that we did, that would be a great introduction to a lot of this stuff. This guy, Merlin Sheldrake, wrote a book just a few years ago called Entangled Life. And that's all, it's a great like overview of the various aspects of fungi. From these ecological roles, a lot about these mycorrhizal interactions with plants. But also the psychoactive stuff. And not a lot about foraging for food, but that's a very important aspect in terms of human interactions with fungi. But Merlin Sheldrake, Entangled Life, fantastic. He's a bit of like a new torchbearer for fungi.
Mm-hmm.
I would say the living legend, the like, you know, hero, you know, king fungus is this guy Paul Stamets. Paul Stamets was a major figure in a documentary from a few years ago called Fantastic Fungi. And it was on Netflix for a while.
Yeah, I watched it.
It's amazing, yeah. And so Paul Stamets is a big figure. I got a bunch of his books right there. He like wrote the book on fungal, on like mushroom cultivation. It's a, like a big contribution. It's just like developing techniques for growing all kinds of different kinds of mushrooms. He's incredible. He really like, I credit him, like, you know, he gets well-deserved recognition for being like the most vocal and prominent like cheerleader for fungi, from the ecological side to the spiritual side to, you know, everything. He's fantastic. And maybe a little overexposed at this point, but that's fine. Well-deserved, like I said. But yeah, this guy Merlin Sheldrake is younger. He's actually the son of this guy that I used to read in the when I was like 17, 18. His dad is this guy Rupert Sheldrake. This very odd scientist. These ideas of morphogenic fields and how information might be able to be transmitted through members of the same species through these non-material waves called morphogenic fields, and you know, this idea like, you know, you can sense when someone's looking at you kind of thing. So he's pretty wacky, but he's dead. This guy Rupert Sheldrake, just have conversations with this guy Terence McKenna, who was a huge figure in the 80s and 90s for promoting like psychoactive fungi and plants, and he was an ethnobotanist, one of these people that like studies like kind of traditional uses of these things.
Talk a bit more about medical applications of fungi?
Well, medical applications are interesting. There are many medical applications. So like the, you know, the drug that's used to suppress the immune system to prevent organ rejection.
Oh,
that's from a fungus. Like that revolutionized, like we, you know, that allowed organ transplantation to occur essentially.
Right? I didn't know that, and I do research on organ yeah. transplants. So.
And, you know, that was just like the soil fungus that is, I mean, when you think about the first antibiotic to be commercialized and like readily available, penicillin, that came from a mold, this ascomycete mold called penicillium. And, you know, a chunk of our antibiotics still come from fungi. Most of them come from bacteria these days, but fungi are still an important source. It's predicted that we've described and identified, discovered maybe 10% of fungi. And so when you think about the important drugs that we've gotten from them and how much is left to discover out there, I have no doubt that there's some like insanely interesting compound, you know, anti-cancer drug, antivirals, like just growing in the soil right on campus here. It's just, who is looking? And again, people are never told about these, you know, this incredible world of this group that's as important, as diverse as like plants and animals. Difficult to see the pathway sometimes there, right? Mm-hmm. It's not typically seen, you know, students, at least at this level, I find rarely consider that that's a viable kind of pathway to go into, right?
Why do you think that? Like, just because lack of education on...
Lack of education is huge.
Yeah.
I think one of the things that attracts me to fungi, especially in my, like, early life, was they do have this outsider status, and people that love fungi love to throw that in people's face, right? It's, oh, there's... Nobody pays attention, but I pay attention. And I know I'm, like, give off that vibe. Yeah, and I give off that vibe, like, very strong. But it's hard not to, because it really is like it's a common frustration of people that pay attention to this stuff, that they're so central to so many things. But part of it is that they're embedded in the landscape. They're not showy. They pop, mushrooms pop up briefly before they return, like rot and return to the earth in a matter of days. Usually that's often our only indication of the existence of fungi,
mm-hmm.
right? They reproduce by microscopic spores. Nobody even knew how they reproduced until microscopes were invented, right? So, you know, history is replete with weird theories about what mushrooms are, right? It's like, they're from where lightning strikes, or it's where semen is spilled on the ground from deer that are rutting. Or they're not even living things. It's just superfluous moisture. Like all these bizarre kind of ideas, because it was just unclear, like, where are they coming from and how are they reproducing? Because again, we tend to think of the fungus as the mushroom, but the mushroom is just the reproductive organ. The actual fungus is, you know, the biggest organism on Earth is a fungus. It's like over 1,000 football fields big, like, you know, on the West Coast. It's been growing for 1,500 years. And the mushrooms it produces are just like tiny little, like, you know, fingernails of the body that that are popping up here and there. I mean, the reproductive structure is a different, you know, part of the body. But, like, but that's the, yeah.
Well, this is just my curiosity, but could you tell us a bit more about psychedelics?
Maybe? Sure. Yeah. I mean, this is a topic that I've never shied away from talking about to people with, because it tends to elicit a little bit of like, oh, is it okay to talk about this? Like, tee hee hee. And it really should, like, this is a very legitimate, like, side of ethnobotany, of mycology, of lots of emerging fields now as well. There used to be a lot of research into psychoactive fungi and LSD, things like this, the 30s and 40s and 50s. Really, 40s, 50s, it got going. But, and then it got all shut down in the 60s because of cultural pressures and so on. But the University of Saskatchewan, there's this guy, Humphrey Osmond, out there that did a lot of pioneering work with treating addiction with psychoactive compounds. I find it very interesting, like, the structure. So, the, you know, students often get, not generally, but like students that are intimidated by chemistry, and when you show them like a chemical structure, you can get kind of like, you know,
yeah,
panicked. But these mushrooms that produce these psychoactive compounds, psilocybin and psilocin, these compounds, if you look at them, if you look at the structure next to serotonin, it's almost exactly the same, right? Serotonin is 5-hydroxytryptamine, so it's based on the amino acid tryptophan. There's a hydroxyl group on carbon number 5, whereas psilocybin is modified on the 4th carbon, and it has 2 methyl groups on this amine end, right? This nitrogenous end. And so the double methyl group seems to allow it to cross into the blood-brain barrier, cross the blood-brain barrier. You can't typically, like, eat serotonin and have it, like, get to your brain, but psilocin will cross. And so that's how it's working. That's how a lot of drugs work, a lot of psychoactive. So you belong to a broader category of psychoactive compounds called tryptamines. So the tryptamine hallucinogens are all based on tryptophan. LSD belongs to that group. It's a semi-synthetic. LSD, in its, like, we'd consider its drug form, is part natural. LSD, it's also from a fungus, but from a disease-causing fungus, disease from plant disease. So ergot is this fungus that parasitizes rye and other, like, cereals, like wheat. And it's likely responsible for things like the Salem witch trials and things like this. And at least there's some suggestion and evidence that, you know, there's been communities that have made bread out of contaminated rye, and then the psychoactive compounds that are in that start making people paranoid and see visions and things like this, and then blame it on their neighbor, whatever. So LSD belongs to that. It's kind of, so Albert Hofmann at Sandoz Laboratories, he was working on that because he knew that it was a vasoconstricting. And so he was just trying to take these molecules from the fungus and modify them as a way to prevent, like, postpartum bleeding, right? Just, like, looking for these strong, like, vasoconstricting molecules. And his 25th batch just happened to be modified in this way that he ended up accidentally ingesting and, you know, tripping out. But yeah, so these tryptamine hallucinogens, including these fungal alkaloids, they work as serotonin agonists in that way. Yeah, and so that a lot of the, like, neurochemistry, molecular biology, things like that, you know, there's still a lot left to understand about how that's having these effects. Therapeutically, it's always, you always have to be very skeptical when things become, like, very in vogue and very hyped. I love that they're getting a lot of attention, but I also can get a little curmudgeon about, like, the overhype with some of these things. Like, oh, it's gonna cure your PTSD. It's gonna do, Maybe not.
No. Right?
There's an enormous amount of evidence for their therapeutic potential, but it's going to start being sold to people and as like a cure-all kind of thing. Or it might. I don't know. I don't want to speculate too much, but just be careful, right? If anybody is thinking about these comments, these are not historically recreational things. These are sacraments that were used in certain cultures by certain individuals, like shamans and the healers of these communities, and they were not taken lightly. And again, like the, you know, these are powerful medicines that in these cultures, and they're used very carefully and thoughtfully in that way. And I think some people get in trouble, you know, with panic attacks, things like that, if they're, you know, thinking they're just gonna have a lot of fun, and then it ends up being more than they bargained for. Yeah. I mean, the good part is that it's not toxic, really, right? It's like the body breaks it down the way we break down serotonin, the enzyme called monoamine oxidase. And so there's like somatic danger is not the issue. It's like, you know, people can have intense experiences that if they're not like ready for or don't integrate well, can do more harm than good. So you can be careful about that kind of thing. But there is a very wonderful, like beautiful, rich history of these. And that's where the ethnobotanist, Richard Evan Schultes, again, there are all these accounts from like missionaries that would go to South America and Mexico and then reported like they're taking this mushroom and they're claiming that they talk to God. That was seen as heretical because they were trying to spread Christianity in the area. So it made the practice retreat into the mountains, and they wouldn't talk to like European people about it. And so it was just kind of this mystery in the literature for like a long time. And then they were kind of like rediscovered, and this healer, Maria Sabina, invited this guy, Gordon Wasson, who was actually a banker, like an American banker guy that got obsessed with fungi after being on his honeymoon with his Russian wife. And his Russian wife was like, they were in the Catskill Mountains in the States. And he was like, oh my God, look at all the mushrooms, and started collecting them. And he was like, you're going to die. You can't eat these things. And their differences in reaction to mushrooms, they got very interested in that. This idea, it's like, why do I see mushrooms as like danger and poison, and you see them as like food and celebration? And so he essentially devoted the rest of his life to fungi, and they wrote a book together. It's like the book about mushroom human history and interactions called Mushrooms, Russia, and History. It's impossible to find. McGill has like a copy in the rare books library. There's like 550 copies worldwide. You can sometimes find one for like $8,000 on like 8 books or something like that. But you can find the PDF, finally. Like, it was only like, you know, it's when I was teaching that fungi course at McGill that was the first time I ever got a hold of it. And just reading the introductory chapter alone, written by Valentina Wasson, she is just, I mean, it's poetry. It's so beautiful. But that has a lot of, that has chapters on like poisonous mushrooms. There's a chapter called Mushrooms for Murderers. There's a couple of species that grow around here that will kill, like there's a few that will kill you. There's a bunch of mushrooms that can make you sick. And there's a few that will kill you. And they generally belong to this genus called Amanita. Amanita verrosa, Amanita phalloides, the death cap, and the destroying angel. They produce these cyclic peptides, and they get accumulated in the liver, and they shut down RNA polymerase. And so if you shut down RNA polymerase, just imagine your liver cells like shut down, right? You can't actually do any gene expression, so your liver shuts down and you die.
What's your favorite mushroom to cook with?
Favorite mushroom to cook with? Right now it's morels, but I hate them all. I mean, it's hard to beat a good chanterelle, but I really like black trumpets. Black trumpets, they're a bit hard to find, and I think they're often neglected because they look like they're rotten when they're perfect. Like, they're black and gray. They don't look appetizing. If you use them to make cream sauce, it turns the sauce like this unpalatable and gray-like color. But they're delicious. So I love them. I love cooking with them. They're very like thin, so they saute really nice and great for risottos and things like that. And they each have their like, they each have their thing. Hedgehog mushrooms are one thing that I've really like grown to appreciate. So hedgehogs, and you can't confuse a hedgehog mushroom with anything. So they're like one of the safest if you're interested in getting into foraging. Hedgehogs are a safe one to start with because there's nothing that makes these little down pointing teeth underneath the cap, and that's poisonous.
Oh.
And they're delicious. So they're common. A lot of people don't really know them. They're not like, you know, they're not on people's radar like chanterelles are. And so they're, you know, depending on the season, this was a really good season supposedly for morels. Last year was not. So depends on the season, depends on temperature, moisture. I've never had a true truffle. Someday I'll actually have like a true black and
white
truffle.
Are they hard to find?
Well, they just they don't grow in North America.
Oh.
So, you know,
yeah.
So they're imported. They're usually incredibly expensive. Even, you know, do I want to spend $100 on a tiny truffle that's spent like, you know, the past month in transit and maybe lost some of its potency?
No.
I mean...
Well, I think we're going to wrap up.
Great.
So thank you, Sharif, for letting us interview you.
Thank you, Lorraine.